Welcome to One True Podcast. My name is Mark Chirino.
And I'm Michael Von Cannon.
In his memoir, A Movable Feast, Ernest Hemingway wrote, "All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know." So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there. In that same spirit of honesty, creativity, and curiosity, One True Podcast explores all things related to Ernest Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Today's show continues our celebration of the centenary of the Paris in Our Time by reading the 18 sketches all together. And Michael, today we are up to chapter 6. We are touring the world along with Hemingway and investigating the young Hemingway's writing technique and finding moments in these sketches that are worthy of our discussion. I'm looking forward to plunging in with you here, Michael, but before we do, why don't we listen to Stacy Keach's performance of Chapter 6 from the Simon & Schuster Short Stories audiobook collection. Here's Stacy Keach.
Chapter 6. They shot the 6 cabinet ministers at 6:30 in the morning against the wall of a hospital. There were pools of water in the courtyard. There were wet dead leaves on the paving of the courtyard. It rained hard. All the shutters of the hospital were nailed shut. One of the ministers was sick with typhoid. 2 soldiers carried him downstairs and out into the rain. I tried to hold him up against the wall, but he sat down in a puddle of water. The other 5 stood very quietly against the wall. Finally, the officer told the soldiers it was no good trying to make him stand up. When they fired the first volley, he was sitting down in the water with his head on his knees.
And there it was, Stacy Keach reading Chapter 6. How wonderful. So how are you doing, Michael?
I'm not doing as well as you because you were actually in the line of totality of eclipse recently. So you got to truly see it. But, you know, I got to see what amounted to like a Pac-Man in the sky in South Florida. But I'm good nonetheless. How about you?
It was worth the hype. It was great. It made moving to Evansville worth it all. It took a while for Evansville to live up to its reputation, but it finally did. So yes, that was a wonderful experience. And can we talk about the experience that Hemingway is describing in Chapter 6? What stands out to you the most in this sketch?
Yeah, I know we're going to get to history a little bit, right? And what's really interesting is the question of history has stood out to me throughout so many of these vignettes. Right. I don't know if it has stood out to you. The first phrase, they shot the 6 cabinet ministers. Who were they? Who were the 6? It's in 1924. Is it that Hemingway just seems to assume that people know this, the trial of the 6, as it were, what has been going on in Greece with this execution, the history of which we'll talk about? Is he assuming that people know it and he doesn't have to discuss it? Or is he assuming that we really don't need to have that kind of historical knowledge for this kind of fiction to be powerful? That kind of question we can discuss really of so many of these vignettes, whether it's the evacuation one or the World War I vignettes that we've talked about so far. It's like how much historical knowledge, how much context do we really have to have in order not just to understand what's going on, but really to make these meaningful as a reading experience. So, I know let's dig into it in a few minutes, but that was really, for me, one of the bigger takeaways.
Yeah, it's a great point because even in the first chapters, Hemingway often particularizes a moment. He'll say Mons, Champagne. So he'll place you in Adrianople. So he will do it. He doesn't do that here. And you're right that maybe in 1924 this would have been evident. But he really doesn't have anything in this sketch that, looking at it 100 years later, places it in Athens or makes it the aftermath of the Greco-Turkish War. It's just an incident.
No, the closest thing is going to be the reference to the six cabinet ministers. That phrase, you know, if you go and search for cabinet ministers or six cabinet ministers, yeah, you're going to pull up information from 1922, from late 1922 about those individuals. But, you know, there are other cabinet ministers from other countries, sure, certainly in the 1920s. But yeah, there's nothing else about this that screams that this is in Greece, that this is in the, again, in connection to the evacuation. And it's amazing how he goes almost out of his way, as we've discussed in other vignettes, to say they, and who are they? We have not had another vignette that has started with they. We have had other vignettes that have started we, and we immediately place ourselves in that kind of first person. But we have not had any vignette so far that has been something like this. They shot the six. And, you know, we might want to talk about what that actually does for us. If we're kind of, in this case, kind of creating a list of things we might want to be talking about, some of the other ideas that really come up as I hear Stacy Keach read it, and as I've kind of read back through it, the hospital, the setting of it, being at the wall of the hospital. Why is the hospital the space? Was the hospital, and I put this in quotes, really the space for this execution or not? And if it's not, why use that as the fictional setting? And there's so much water.
Yeah, right.
There's so much water throughout this. And so, again, the setting of puddles and rain and this man's head in the water at the end, it becomes almost a refrain throughout. And because of that, it's going to be important. And because we have not only read this, but certainly we've read other Hemingway, rain and water are so significant. So what is the significance of it here?
Those are all great. I wanted to pick up, actually, before we go on to new territory, I wanted to talk about the pronouns that you started this off. They shot the six cabinet ministers. And this is an example of a sketch where the I narrator never appears. So we don't know who this observer is and what his role is. Is he an objective journalist, as Hemingway supposedly was during the Greco-Turkish War? Who is the they? Does that emerge during the sketch? So we have they shot six cabinet ministers. They tried to hold him up against the wall. We have two soldiers, one of the ministers. We have an officer. So how clear are we about who's doing what to whom?
Yeah, we're not clear from the beginning. Is they the people executing? Is they the entire country? Is it much more impersonal,
right,
than that? But I do like your point that it sounds journalistic, in some ways more journalistic than the previous pieces that we've been looking at. It's been kind of touch and go, the kind of journalistic voice that we have here. And in some ways, that's been connected with the way that Hemingway might have received some of the kind of raw material for these pieces, whether it's from McAllman or whether it's from Chink Dorman Smith and so on and so forth. This one has almost, it has the sound of journalism, but you would never really start a piece that way, really. What's really interesting here in terms of how Hemingway writes his own journalistic pieces, there's also this kind of human interest element to it, right? So at the beginning, we have they, we have them, we have the six, we have all these kind of groups, but then notice how it narrows down. We have the two, and then we have the one, and we stay with the one. One of the ministers was sick with typhoid, and then by the end, when they fired the first volley, he was sitting down in the water with his head on his knees. And, you know, it's such a, an amazing strategy that Hemingway uses. He's going to, in so much journalism, he's going to show us how he, it's almost like he's going to, at a meta level, show us how he kind of goes about writing a journalistic piece. When he's writing about Mussolini, it's as much about kind of Hemingway's own experience encountering the subject matter of Mussolini as it is about writing the piece itself, and so on and so forth. That kind of personal angle to it shows up here too, where like he wants to start with this big group, this big kind of national idea about a kind of public execution, and then bring us into a single individual.
So if it were a journalistic piece, you'd have to think that they would have said they executed the six cabinet ministers, or the six cabinet ministers were mm-hmm. executed. Saying shot, and we know this from chapter five, and you know, we shot them, like shot is what they did during war. So executed would give it a more clinical, legal, sort of a judicial outcome. So he's reminding us that no, they were just murdered mm-hmm. in cold blood, right? And execution is a much more benign, I think, description of it than shot, especially within the first sentence, right? Secondly, if you just look at the way sentence two and sentence three work in relationship with each other, there were pools of water in the courtyard. There were wet, dead leaves on the paving of the courtyard. So yes, I agree that this has a journalistic tone, but that reads like two T.S. Eliot lines going back to back, right? The variation of that image, the pools of water, that seems I love that Hemingway-esque variation from one image to another.
And what's it doing there? We've just finished with the wall of the hospital. We are now going to be talking in a few sentences about it raining and the shutters of the hospital being nailed shut. Like, you can understand those sentences. We have a hospital wall. We have it raining. We have the shutters nailed. That all makes sense. But there's this kind of movement in terms of focus to a pool of water, to wet dead leaves. They don't sound yet like they're going to be important. They seem almost inconsequential as details right now, right?
Until the last sentence.
Exactly.
Right. And then we go to, it rained hard, not it was raining hard. So we have there were, and it rained hard. And then all the shutters of the hospital were nailed shut. So it's kind of, it rained hard is an unexpected past tense. That the sequence would suggest that it should have said it was raining hard. And then all the shutters of the hospital were nailed shut. So by logic, they were nailed shut to keep the rain out. Or is there any other reason that the hospital would have nailed the shutters shut.
So you couldn't see out. I think that's another important point there, is like there's this lack of visibility, and that creates some of the irony, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, you know, if we're talking about, correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, but if we're talking about what, this is a blanket statement. But if we're talking about kind of what truly would have happened, I was looking at the newspaper. Yeah. The New York Times reporting on this. They were taken from Averroff prison. It was around 11 o'clock. And like, then they're going to be taken kind of to the outskirts of Athens. Mm-hmm. I don't know if a hospital is involved in that or not, but it's important that Hemingway, he's going to situate us at a hospital, a place of care, recovery, rehabilitation, all of this. And yet that's the place of an execution.
Just like in chapter 7, we have a church.
Another wall.
Exactly. So this is in, it's like storytelling 101. If it were the wall of a coffee shop or a factory, that's one thing, but a hospital. Perfect. And you're right. And there's no, so, you know, I'm not one to masquerade as a expert of the Greco-Turkish War, but none of the accounts that I read said a thing about a hospital. It was against a wall of a building, but of course it was too rich for Hemingway to not make it a hospital. So
if you have it raining, then you can have the shutters down. But like you said, you can have the shutters down as well for this lack of visibility or this desire to not see, right? We don't need to see. We can't see. We don't want to see what's going on.
This might be an appropriate time, since you brought up some of the historical background, just to situate this. And again, like to go back to what literally the first thing we were talking about is, I didn't know any of this. I've been reading this sketch for years and I didn't bother to look up the history. So this has been a great exercise of figuring out who were the ministers and why were they shot and who was doing the shooting and what was the context. So, can we talk a little bit about what Hemingway captures from historical reality and what he invents? Can we try to figure out where that line is?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll jump in answering that and then please jump in with what you have. What we can talk about, of course, is that, you know, King Constantine I, he's deposed in 1917 in large part because he maintained a kind of neutrality. You have the allies who want him on the French and British side during the war. You, in fact, have the prime minister of Greece who wants this, who's kind of pro-ally and wants this alliance. But King Constantine maintains this neutrality, which in many cases amounts to a kind of pro-German position, right? And so he's deposed at that point in 1917, and then he's going to return to power in the 1920s, and he kind of inherits what we've been talking about before, which is this Greco-Turkish war situation that leads to this conflict in Smyrna and this evacuation. When that failure takes place in Smyrna, it in many ways becomes this not just a disaster for the country, it becomes a disaster for Constantine and for the advisors and for his neutrality policies. And he and his advisors take the blame for this evacuation that has occurred, the deaths that are occurring, this refugee situation and humanitarian crisis that's taking place. So I think he spends the rest of his life actually in exile, but you have six of these ministers. Many of them were premiers, or you had generals and so on and so forth. So they weren't necessarily all at the same government level, but they are going to be tried in this trial of the six. And so that becomes very much the context for this text itself. And I did want to say that Hemingway is very much, we've been talking about how much history do we need to know. You know, when he's writing to someone like Ezra Pound, he's very much aware of what's going on. Here's his letter to Pound on the 5th of August, 1923. Hemingway says, "They should each one be headed chapter one, chapter two, etc. When they're read all together, they all hook up. It seems funny, but they do. The bulls start, then reappear, then finish off. The war starts clear and noble, just like it did, moans, etc. Gets close and blurred and finished." And then he says, "The refugees leave Thrace due to the Greek ministers who are shot." Right. And so he's talking about what we've been discussing the past couple of weeks, which is how Mons is it's perceived as a noble war. It's innocent and naive. And he tries to capture that in those vignettes. And then he's really connecting the refugee, the evacuation situation to what these ministers have done. And when you look at the historical account of them, like why they were actually charged and why they were actually executed, right? There are so many. I'm looking at the New York Times one, for instance. In the language of the journalists, these ministers hid people from the danger to Greece of Constantine's return. Like with Constantine's return, there was the danger of neutrality. Of quote, breaking away from these alliances. Constantine puts Greece in a more precarious position, certainly in the aftermath of the war. And the other part of it is that these ministers did a lot of this for their own gain.
So the charge was of treason,
mm-hmm.
right? They were executed for treason, and whatever their activities or involvement was, it was pretty clear at the time that they were being scapegoated. Is that your understanding? It's almost like even when they were, it's almost like the trial was kind of a sham.
I certainly think that there was a large faction of Greece still in support, pro-royalists, right? At the same time, there were many who were not. And you also, when it happened, you also had the Turks stepping in and saying, see, this is exactly what we thought the Greeks were, right? They are savages.
My understanding is that in recent years, these six were exonerated. They did sort of a trial, sort of a retroactive trial. Of course, it doesn't do them very much good now since they were executed, but their names were at least cleared according to Greek law. And the second part of this, Michael, is the execution itself. And the mechanics of the execution, and that too is kind of fascinating when it comes to what actually happened, and then how Hemingway describes it. And so the real prominent moment in chapter 6 is one of the ministers was sick with typhoid. Two soldiers carried him downstairs and out into the rain. They tried to hold him up against the wall, but he sat down in a puddle of water. So Hemingway really isolates this one feeble, sick man who ends up getting executed anyway. So is it conclusive how true that incident was?
Milton Cohen does a really good job in Hemingway's Laboratory of saying, New York Times, they cover almost how there's almost this tone of chivalry when it comes to these six cabinet ministers, right? They're silent, and at moments they're almost joyously kind of conversing with each other, and then they are kind of taking this punishment like men. And they don't refer to typhoid at all in the New York Times reporting, but then it is the Paris Tribune coverage in which typhoid actually shows up. And I think Milton Cohen's point is that Hemingway would have read that paper, and he really would have certainly been interested in how typhoid itself was present in the execution and uses it there. And so I think that's a really, not just a perceptive point, but a persuasive kind of point, because it's not anywhere in the New York Times reporting. Right. What I do find interesting about the New York Times reporting, though, is that you do have in various days of accounting, you do have out of the six, there's like one particular cabinet minister. It's like General Hadjanestes, if I'm getting his name correct. Here it is. General Hadjanestes wore his usual air of nervousness and restlessness. That's one of the reports and one of the ways he's described. And then it's described that all of his, like medals are torn from him and his sword is being bent. And it's interesting that he's separated. The way he's described in a few different reports, he's separated from the other characters. And of course, I'm not making a one-to-one connection between him and the one that's being described here, but it is curious how there's an individual who shows up who you might, because of the way that they are treated or the way that they might face death in a very different way, maybe in a more human way, for readers, I don't know, there's empathy there. There's at least a different kind of connection than you might form with this other kind of group.
The New York Times article describes they're joking around. The condemned men are joking around with the executioners. One gives a cigarette lighter to one of the people who's going to. And it's almost the account is almost that, not really that they're so brave going to their execution, but that the charges are so ludicrous and that they don't even they don't feel guilty or certainly not ashamed of what they did. So they think the whole thing is outrageous. It's like a farce. And Hemingway doesn't really put that political thread to it. It's, in fact, do you think that there's any sign of bravery or courage in chapter six? The reason I ask is because this is really one of Hemingway's massive themes to his career, is people under crisis or about to be executed or under the threat of violence, how do they behave?
Mm-hmm.
When death is imminent, how do you behave? Do you die well or badly? So do you see any of that in chapter six?
Yeah, the question of courage. If I could go back to one of the articles, and this is from the New York Times on December 1st, 1922, Greeks take steps to arraign prince. And this is in a section called Refused to be Blindfolded. Yeah. So it's after this description of them, you know, lighting cigarettes and all that. And also after the nervousness and restlessness of that one particular general. Here's a quote. The condemned men were immaculately dressed, and they showed no emotion as they alighted from the motor cars and walked to the square formed by the waiting troops. They took places at equal intervals, each man facing his own firing squad of 12 men, and refused to be blindfolded. So like in that kind of description, I don't know, the way they are dressed, the way they are emotionless, the way they take on these 12 soldiers with rifles in their own way. I don't know if that's there to show courage in that description. And if it is it contrasted, or is it in some ways being depicted in Hemingway's reference to how the other five stood very quietly against the wall? Is quietly the closest we get to a kind of courage? It seems weaker. It seems a weaker kind of description than the one I just read from the newspaper, but I don't know how you read that.
I agree that he could have chosen an adverb that would have conveyed more strength, but it's really interesting. Remember, we had in the earlier sketch, there was the silence and then the woman screaming during childbirth. So Hemingway is using, and we can imagine the volley of the execution to break up the silence. You know, in the New York Times article, so in the actual executions, and you know, I don't want to go overly historical on this, but of the six cabinet ministers, apparently one of them died of a heart attack as they were driving them, or as they were preparing them for execution. You would think that,
is that right?
Hemingway would have included. So one had typhoid, one had already died, and then there were four left. Hemingway, and this is Michael Reynolds' conclusion when Reynolds notes this disparity, he's like, you know what? That's too confusing, too much detail. I want to focus on the sick guy who's about to be killed, not the guy who's already dead. There's no drama there.
So he
highlights that. And I think that's obviously a typically great reading by Michael S. Reynolds in the article called Two Hemingway Sources for In Our Time. This episode of One True Podcast is supported by the Hemingway Review, the scholarly journal of the Ernest Hemingway Foundation and Society. Michael and I are excited about the fall 2023 issue with guest editors Ian Marshall and Margaret E. Wright Cleveland, where their theme for this issue is Hemingway in Black and White. It's a fascinating collection of voices tackling a wide range of issues related to Hemingway and race. For this special issue and back issues, please visit HemingwaySociety.org/journals. One True Podcast is proud to announce that this In Our Time episode is sponsored by Simon & Schuster Audio, which provided Stacy Keach's beautiful introduction to today's show. The Simon & Schuster Audio Collection is an absolute treasure. Check out their entire Hemingway collection of audiobooks, including Stacy Keach's epic performance of all of Hemingway's short stories, collected in the Unabridged Short Stories Gift Edition. Michael, the entire Hemingway catalog or selected titles are available for download or on CD, including the legendary Donald Sutherland reading The Old Man and the Sea, John Slattery from Mad Men performing A Farewell to Arms, the late William Hurt's brilliant take on The Sun Also Rises, and others.
Absolutely. In fact, I just spent a long car ride across Florida listening to Campbell Scott's reading of For Whom the Bell Tolls, and it was great company.
Visit the Hemingway page at HemingwayAudiobooks.com to order Hemingway audiobooks from our friends at Simon & Schuster Audio.
Tell me this, though. So we had been talking earlier when we were discussing the first bullfighting vignette where we have the kid showing up, and the kid seems to, if I'm remembering our discussion correctly, seems to really contrast with the other bullfighters. He has to fight so many bulls. And even though he gets sick, he's able to do it. Does it make it stronger that we have this, in this account, that we have this individual being executed who has his head there in the water at that moment, and the other five are kind of, they're standing quietly against the wall. They're not stoic, whatever kind of language you want to discuss. Or would it have made it stronger if there's more contrast between them, where he can't even sit up or stand to face his death, but they are able to? Would that disparity have made it stronger? And if not, why is this making it stronger?
It seems like he's not doing very much with the other five.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what that does is, like, if this were a picture, those five would be very blurry and small and way in the background. And this one really pathetic, in the real meaning of the word pathetic, would occupy most of the frame. So it's a choice. And you make, you know, if I think if he said if the other five stood stoically or bravely, suddenly that becomes a dominant aspect of the sketch. So I think what it really does is it really sharpens our focus on this one guy. There's also the question that I think most readers are going to come away with is, do you really have to kill somebody who doesn't even have the strength to stand up? I mean, he's so sick that, you know, executing him, what sense does it really make? Michael, I kind of want to extend this and maybe get your reaction to this. There's two other executions in Hemingway's work that comes to mind. And the first is when Hemingway is describing the Caporetto retreat in A Farewell to Arms, and Frederick gets to the Tagliamento River. He sees that there's essentially a firing squad there questioning somebody, and the guy they're questioning right before they were going to kill Frederick, probably, he's like, listen, if you're going to kill me, just do it, but stop with the stupid questions. And to me, that's a kind of feistiness that we don't see in chapter 6. It's a kind of, I know you guys are ridiculous. This whole thing is stupid. So just do it. That's, I'm thinking about that. I'm also thinking about For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Oh, yeah.
The execution of the fascists, when there's all the various ways that all the various townspeople get executed. And there's one guy who literally can't stand up.
Mm-hmm.
His legs are just too weak, too wobbly. Not because of typhoid like this, but that's another thing. So it comes to mind. There's all the various, Hemingway seemed utterly, do you have executions in mind in Hemingway's work that help us explore this topic that he seemed to return to over and over?
I mean, the For Whom the Bell Tolls one was the, and certainly Farewell to Arms, but the For Whom the Bell Tolls one was the biggest for me. And I think it's the biggest because it's such an extended scene and there's so much repetition to it. And it's being told kind of in this a narrative within a narrative. And Hemingway, I don't know, Hemingway does not do that too much. You see, obviously, he's a master of dialogue, but he does not necessarily allow other characters to kind of take on the storytelling, a story within a story with that much space, as he will do in something like For Whom the Bell Tolls. It's so experimental in that way. I mean, I love that moment. And what I love about it is like you start to feel for these characters that you are like, I shouldn't be feeling so conflicted in this way. These characters are pathetic.
Yeah.
There's pathos there. There's emotion there for these kinds of characters. It's not good versus bad. That's not the kind of war landscape that Hemingway is wanting to explore.
The other work that might help us shed a little bit of light on this. Michael, I'm going to come at you a little bit from left field on this. So I remember Hemingway talking about Tintoretto's Crucifixion of Christ. And I know very little about art history, so I'm not going to pretend that I do. But I was really struck by Hemingway's bombastic comments about this painting. He loved this piece of art so much. And then he said that from Tintoretto, and I'm paraphrasing here, I'm really sorry, I don't have the exact quote, but I seem to remember that he said, from Tintoretto's Crucifixion, he learned how to write executions. Because of the guy, the condemned man on the right, which was on Jesus's left, who is, so the guy on the right is prone, supine, either dead or about to die. The guy on the other side is struggling. And I think those were the moments that Hemingway found so gripping. I remember we talked to Carl Eby about the manuscript of the Garden of Eden, and one of the excised lines that were in the manuscript was, I used to go to the Boulevard Arago at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I remember the thud of the head. Like, wow, he used to, maybe he did do that. Maybe Hemingway did go to public executions.
Mm.
So this was a source of fascination for Hemingway.
Where was he seeing the Tintoretto?
It's in the San Rocco in Venice, which he wouldn't have seen until the 40s. I mean, he could have looked at the picture. He could have seen the picture in a book, right?
That's true.
And Michael, this topic is related to the way bulls act when they're about to be killed in bullfights and the way matadors act when they're in confrontation. So this notion of execution is just really an extreme example of what he tried to demonstrate all the time. You know, you were mentioning this at the beginning of our chat. So pools of water, wet dead leaves, it rained hard, and the puddles of water, which end up becoming, you know, crucial in this sketch. But, you know, it seems like in the historical accounts, rain wasn't really a factor in this historical incident. It was like Hemingway invented it.
Yeah, I'm not seeing any reference to there being a deluge.
No.
That day. You know, whether he's inventing it or not, he certainly is focused on it. And so what happens here is, yeah, we have the head in water at the end. We have the dead leaves at the beginning, which seem to foreshadow, of course, what's going to be occurring. We have him sitting down in water in the middle. And so, yeah, the real question being in, you know, maybe I've answered some of it. Like, why is it there? What would it have? What would have been different if it had been a sunny day? Rain is, I think we're always, as Hemingway readers, on the lookout for rain.
Yeah, I mean, in Caporetto, we know it actually did rain during that retreat. So when he repeats "in the rain" dozens of times, there's it's thematically important, but also historically accurate. Here, it seems like the water is the thread that goes all throughout. And I really, what we were saying earlier, how when they fired the first volley, he was sitting down in the water with his head on his knees. And we're kind of prepared for that moment, how your last instant on earth is sitting in a puddle outside a hospital suffering from typhoid. Like, that is as brutal as it gets.
And it also reminds me, though, in the evacuation retreat scene where the
it rained all through
minarets,
the evacuation, right?
Yeah. They're stuck up in the rain across the mudflats. We have the river itself where the water is nearly up to the bridge. And my goodness, we were talking about how execution scenes are important. Bridge scenes are important in their own way to Hemingway. But yeah, it rained all through the evacuation. So, you know, rain's important in different ways and in those different vignettes. And at the same time, rain ties them together, just as Hemingway's, I don't know, he's causally wanting to tie these, right? These are historically tied together, the execution and the evacuation that has occurred. Or for him, the ministers that come in with Constantine and the evacuation that occurs and then the execution that occurs.
Michael, would you weigh in on the last sentence? So as we were reading it, when they fired the first volley, he was sitting down in the water with his head on his knees. Is there anything surprising about that sentence? I'm not sure everybody would have sequenced the clauses of that sentence exactly like that.
It's like I'm taking a quiz. Hold on.
Yes. Well, you should expect that.
In terms of emphasis, certainly what happens right now is we don't know what they are firing at until we do. And so, you know what I mean? When they fired the first volley, we don't know exactly what position he's in. We don't know, but what that allows Hemingway to do is put him into this position, this really sad. If you were talking about painting before, this could be painted, and it'd be kind of a lasting image for us, this really sad figure sitting in the water. And that's the last image that we have. You know, if we were to have that phrased a different way, it would end with a different kind of action instead of ending with him.
I like that. That must be exactly the answer. The last image is not of the volley, but of the head on the knees. And I think that's fantastic. I'm glad I asked, Michael. That was really helpful.
I'm glad I was able to answer that quiz question. Oh my goodness. Yeah.
All that's going to do is invite more interrogation in the future. I wanted to just think holistically about the six that we've looked so far. So, Champagne, Spain, Adrianople, Mons again, Athens, and we're going to Italia for chapter 7. So we're really all over the place. In this book of sketches, in our time, 18 sketches, we're in America twice, right? This quintessentially American author really sets this in Europe more than America. One takeaway after digesting all six of these sketches is I've really come to look for those short, punchy, objective sentences that seem to be real moments of power during the sketches. Remember, we talked about scared, sick, looking at it, or we shot them from the previous sketches. And here we have, it rained hard. Those, just those three words, like how he uses it both rhythmically, dramatically, to kind of punctuate the action of the sketch. This would become his reputation. If you said, oh, Hemingway wrote short sentences. Well, no, he doesn't, you know, but when he does, it's artful and it's strategic. And since this is, he's really making his first entrance into the stage, it's just interesting to see when he does it and how he does it and what its effect is on the sketch. So we're a third of the way there, and I'm definitely going to be looking for that over the next 12, along with the setting. Are you, anything that you're going to be, what are your eyes open for the next two thirds?
You know, reading it the way that we've read it, I'm more attuned now than I have been before to the voicing of these. The voicing is just so dynamic. It's so wide ranging. I'm looking for that later on. I'm looking to see where else we go. As you said, we're all over the map. Well, where else are we going to fly to in these later vignettes? But I'm also, maybe the last thing that I'll say here, there are more things I'm looking forward to. But the last thing I'll say here is, you know, Hemingway was, of course, taken for someone many times who would just kind of put his journalism down on paper and call it fiction. And he bemoaned that. And he's showing time and again how he's going to use his own journalistic writing in a certain way, or he's going to use other kinds of journalism, right? Other kinds of reporting, and do something really interesting kind of fictively, or he's going to take hearsay and put it down on paper. He's going to take what his friends are saying. He's doing so much here to show the way that fiction gets written.
Are you also, in the next 12 sketches, interested to hear me talk more about Tintoretto?
Yeah, let's do it, you know?
You did not have that on your bingo card, and there it was.
Any kind of Italian painters you want to bring up, let's do this.
Michael, thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Always fun.
And thanks to you all for listening in. This episode and past episodes are available wherever you get your podcasts. Our book, One True Sentence, Writers and Readers on Hemingway's Art, is available anywhere books are sold. So we encourage you to pick up a copy or two and enjoy more Hemingway talk. You can also support this podcast by leaving us a rating and telling your friends all about us. Feel free to write us at onetruepod@gmail.com. That's the number one, truepod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. This episode and all In Our Time episodes are made possible by a generous grant from Indiana Humanities in cooperation with the National Endowment for the Humanities. This show is also supported by the Hemingway Society and Florida Gulf Coast University. Join us next time as we continue exploring Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Until then, I'm Mark Chirino with Michael Von Cannon, and this is One True Podcast. Come on, come on.